Welcome to the Eucatastrophe, where we meander through politics, pop culture, church, society, to consider true human ends and how life may be enchanted. I'm Joel Harrison. I'm joined as always by my co-host, Dave, and we're incredibly glad you could join us. Dave has been at a film last night. He went and saw Shazam, and he went without me, so he's lucky I'm talking to him. But also, Dave, we saw Captain Marvel, and I was interested in what you thought about Captain Marvel. I'm raising films because we're going to discuss a film in this episode today. But Dave, we went and saw Captain Marvel, and Dave wrote a really interesting review of Captain Marvel, in which he talks about feminism, and he says, "We have allowed it to bear deadly fruit on Earth." This is fascinating stuff, Dave. Really powerful, hard-hitting. He says in this article, this is Dave, "We seek to empower little girls everywhere to be strong like men." You know, I at this point, I think he's condemning Captain Marvel. And then Dave says, "We ought to lament that feminist lust cannot be appeased, even with blood. We're sending mothers into the flames," writes Dave, "the carnage of battlefield." And then he finishes just on this really powerful note. "Jesus did not put his woman forward, and neither should we." I mean, obviously Dave's excluding all the martyrs at this point. But Dave, that's just a really, just some really good insights.
that was, of course, words not by me, but by Greg Boss from Design God, who also says, "Yes, Marvel may be on the verge of ruining a decade-long movie saga with identity politics. So what? Will we fuss about this than the government sending our daughters?" Then he actually goes on to talk about the military policy in America, allowing women. This is incredible. If you would like, we'll put a link in the description. Maybe we shouldn't.
No, we shouldn't. We should. Look, Captain Marvel was an all right film.
Yes.
That's what we actually think. It was okay. It didn't do all the... It actually wasn't as hardcore feminist as we would have liked, I think, is probably part of the issue there. But it was, you know, it was solid.
It was solid. It had some good ideas in it.
Yeah. 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 Anyway, we're going to talk about a really interesting film, Dave. Yeah,
we're now going to talk about an incredibly depressing film.
Hold on. It's depressing, but it's, you know, it's also affirming and has some, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I actually posted on the Eucatastrophe page today a quote from Eagleton saying that tragedy doesn't exclude the possibility of hope, but something like, "It only hopes through a veil of tears," or something like
right,
that.
Right, right.
So it is tragic.
This is the Eucatastrophe.
Possibly hopeful as well. So I watched, and then Joel watched, a film called First Reformed from 2017, which I thought was a spectacular film. We'll hear a bit about what Joel thinks a bit later. But it's written and directed by Paul Schrader, one of the most celebrated screenwriters of all time, whose writing credits include Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, The Last Temptation of Christ. So some of the greatest screenplays ever written.
We should tell people at this point that if they don't want spoilers.
Yes.
If they don't want spoilers for this film, then go away and watch it. It is well worth the watch. And then come listen to the episode. But our discussion today is going to be also on some general ideas and some interesting points of
So if you think you're not going to get around to watching it, I think this will be worth listening as well.
Hopefully we'll
but
have
I do admonish you. I rarely admonish anyone, but I admonish you to watch it, especially if you're a pastor. I think there's a lot of wisdom to be found in it.
And Captain Marvel.
No. I also think Paul Schrader, the director of this film, I think he only directed one other film and a few short films. He's also an incredibly spiritually informed person. I think he still practices some form of Christian faith, but he grew up in a reformed setting, and you can kind of see these allusions. Obviously, the Last Temptation of Christ has some spiritual themes in it, but you know, things like Taxi Driver and The Raging Bull as well also have deep kind of religious themes. He's also written a book that I found out about through reading. There's a great article, by the way, review of of First Reform by Joel's friend Alyssa Wilkinson. And she talked about a book that he wrote about the cinematic style of transcendent filmmaking, which sounds really interesting. Hopefully going to have a look at it. But First Reformed, what's it about? It follows the story of a guy called Tola, played by Ethan Hawke, really powerfully played by Ethan Hawke, actually, who is a minister at a historic Dutch Reformed church in upstate New York. And the church, it's called First Reformed, has a tiny congregation of maybe five people or so. And the church is kept afloat by the patronage of a large mega church, might be a bit of a stretch, but a much larger church with a kind of seat of thousands kind of thing, with all these different adjacent services and things offered. Huge
media,
yeah,
media wing,
yeah. So a very slick operation. That said, it's never kind of completely demonized or anything like that. But it's a church called Abundant Life. And even Toller at times, when people kind of come to him, he refers them on to the proper church up the road. And this church kind of pays his salary as well as things like repairs for the organ and things like that. From the very beginning, we see Toller's church functioning more as a museum or monument to the local area's history, with the motivation for keeping it actually running being more of a kind of a historical fascination. And it's also kind of historically significant because it was a significant site in the Underground Railway, kind of taking slaves from the south into the north during the Civil War. And the impending kind of 250th anniversary celebration forms kind of the backdrop. I think it's like a reconsecration service that's kind of impending, that forms the kind of backdrop of the narrative as it goes on. Now, Toller is kind of shown kind of constantly doing historical tours of his church. He's more of a tour guide than a minister, perhaps. He's also sells merchandise from his place, which makes one of the staff at Abundant Life call his church the gift shop, which he kind of, you can tell, takes kind of personally. Toller is a fascinating character as our central character of the film. He himself is a man in the midst of this kind of deep personal crisis of a deep spiritual nature. We discover that he's lost a son in Afghanistan after encouraging him to sign up. So Toller himself was a chaplain in the army. His father was also in the army, and he kind of encouraged his son to join as kind of a family tradition. After the death of the son, his wife left him, Toller's wife left him because she could never forgive him for encouraging him to enlist. And Toller actually acknowledges that the war itself was immoral. And he also possibly had an affair, I think, with a parishioner, but that's unclear. We also know that his health is failing. There's a rather horrible scene where he's painfully filmed urinating blood, probably due to his alcoholism. We've seen drinking lots and lots. Anyway, the narrative of the film kind of moves along when his life is interrupted by the appearance of Mary, who is a young pregnant woman who asks him to see go about kind of pastoring her husband, who is an environmental activist who's in absolute despair about the future of the planet, so much so that the husband, Michael, is encouraging Mary to have an abortion because he can't see the justice of bringing a child into the world. And he's kind of invigorated by being called in to pastor this person. And this actually leads to a bit of a spiritual reawakening and also a political and ethical awakening. So that's the least spoily description that I can give of it at the moment. Joel, what did you think about the film?
I really enjoyed it. It is visually arresting. So this notion of transcendental significance in film is in itself, just for that very purpose, something quite wonderful to watch. So there's scenes that are clearly have an overt transcendental significance at one point, and in a quite an awkward way that made me feel very uncomfortable.
Mm.
He is in a scene where he is literally bearing the weight of this pregnant woman, Mary, upon himself. And it looks obviously in a Christ-like fashion, and they are transcended and start imagining themselves floating across mountains and things. But it also just that the simplicity of focusing in on a glass of whiskey, trees as they're riding through and so on. And so there's quite arresting beauty throughout penetrating this film, which is part of the theme that in the midst of despair, that there can be springs of hope and of, you know, beauty. You know, one thing that the film does is it's orientated, or at least it's interesting because it drops out, but it begins at least with him journaling. In which he commits himself to write all his thought uncensored in the hope that it becomes almost a form of prayer and that if God is listening, when God listens, he'll listen. And it's interesting because in ways that drops out, right? And by the end of the film, he's editing by ripping out the pages and so on. And so it shows throughout the film that there is this, this search for his own interiority that then turns into a self-disintegration.
It's fascinating. And I think he's a disciple of Thomas Merton, I think he's basing these practices on. There's this beautiful line in it where he says that the intention to pray is can be a form of prayer.
Right.
I really loved that.
Yeah, and watching it, I was confronted by sort of two questions from this. One is how difficult it is, in fact, to pray. How the spiritual discipline of praying can be so difficult because it opens you up both to silence and it opens you up to an absence of vocabulary for yourself, for example. And the second point was when you go searching into your own interiority, which this film is so beautifully demonstrates. This is a minister who is searching into himself for answers to questions both existential for himself and also for the future of humanity itself, and then the nature of church and the incongruity he finds himself in. Where does that interiority lead him? Like, where can our own interiority, when we search, you know, when we examine the depths of ourselves, where is the destination of that inquiry?
So to move on to the point, and really, if you want to watch this film at all, stop now. What ends up happening is Mary calls in Tola, Mary the pregnant woman, calls in Tola and shows him a suicide vest that Michael has constructed to detonate himself and destroy either some people, I think, or I think the target might have been a local refinery. Tola kind of confiscates the vest to bring it up with him the next day in the next meeting. Tola goes to meet him. Turns out Michael has killed himself. Tola then hides the vest and then partially cares for Mary, conducts the funeral at the site of this kind of environmental devastation caused by a local industry. And it's a very beautifully shot sequence where there's a platform laid out with Mary sitting on stage and the priest conducting the funeral with the backdrop of this environmental kind of desolation. And then a choir singing a Neil Young song, I think, in response to it. But over the course of the next few weeks, Tola becomes much more radicalized. He starts reading all of Michael's materials about what the fate of the planet over the next 50 years will be, and he becomes much more radical and much more desperate, even as he seeks to care for Mary. And then schisms form between him and the bigger church, and we find out that the polluting industries are actually bankrolling that church and even bankrolling the 250th anniversary service. Tola ends up in desperation deciding to put on the suicide vest and blow himself up at the service. At the last minute, he changes his mind, takes off the vest, and then wraps his bare torso in some rusted old barbed wire that he'd found in the graveyard of his church, and puts his clerical clothes over, is about to commit suicide and is interrupted by Mary. They embrace, kiss, and the film ends. And we're kind of just left with this, I don't know about you, Joel, utter devastation over the situation. But the film just raises such fascinating questions about hope and despair. What can we hope for the next generation? Is it just to bring children into the world? It raises questions about the church's vocation in the face of this devastation and things like that. And there's actually kind of deep theological imagery there as well. But Joel, what do you have any reflections on those things?
Well, this descent that this character goes into, it seems to begin with an understanding that interiority, as you mentioned in the last episode when Augustine talks about it, the place where one finds God is actually in the intimacy of self-presence.
Mm.
That interiority is a step on the road to God, finding the master within who illuminates one's vision. But actually what that means to do is to then actually to find God, then also for Augustine becomes orientating oneself to a community. So it's interesting in this movie, he starts with more of a pastoral orientation, talks to Michael, and he talks about that God can be creative and present in goodness and beauty, even amidst the ultimate despair of environmental degradation and so on. That there is nevertheless good. This child that is born has a goodness to them, even without it's not to say that cataclysmic climate catastrophe is not going to happen. But then he starts there, but as he continues to turn inward, it seems to me in this film, it's fascinating because the depths of his feelings and so on actually begin to almost become, and it's overlaying with his body itself as disintegrating. There's almost a certain self-centeredness or solipsism that then develops that is almost like a parodic holiness. He becomes quite vicious in some senses, understandably, and so on. But there's something there about the internal journey into oneself can actually become not an orientation towards God and the other, but actually locked into sort of the prison of one's own despair.
Yeah, because I think there's multiple ways of reading what's going on for him as a character. It could be that he's it becomes kind of a solipsistic spirituality. But it also, you could read it as a type of kenosis, of self-emptying in a positive sense. Mm. So that we interpret the ending of actually this Christological image of Tola forswearing violence as the means of bringing about justice. He forswears the destruction of evildoers as the means about which he's going to bring justice, and instead he will take on himself
which is the
suffering of the world.
And it's affirming in that sense, and I think that's right. Like, it's affirming because this is at all the time of his despair, God is not, I mean, God is silent, but nor is he absent, right? There is no point, there in my reading, there is no point that despite his despair, there is no point in which he ceases to be, you know, a man of the cloth, right?
Yeah.
There is no point in which that, but there is this sort of tension that I think runs through film itself. I mean, it made me, the reason, partly it's uncomfortable, I think, because watching that kind of self-disintegration, you know, you can see he starts tearing out the pages of his journal, which is a kind of form of self-editing that is kind of...
what he expressly says at the beginning, that this process is not edited. So he will not go back and cross out anything. He'll say exactly what comes to his mind and just keep going, which I actually think sounds like a wonderful and challenging process, but you actually see the corruption of that process throughout the film.
Yeah, which it turns into a sort of, you know, stepping into oneself. And you've raised this before we were discussing that the character Mary becomes almost a prop for him. And in ways it echoes something we talked about with the TV show Legion, in which woman can become kind of the burden bearers for men in their solipsistic quests to either be heroes or martyrs.
Yeah, that's right. And that's what my big problem with the narrative actually is. Women, there are ways you could read it as quite affirming of
Well, I think it's purposefully like that though.
But it's incredibly painful. Like there's one point in which he confronts the woman that he'd had some sort of prior relationship with, who is now a choir master at Abundant Life Church, and she's constantly asking him to go to the doctor because he's obviously dying. At one point he just snaps at her and calls her a stumbling block and says, I think he says she disgusts him for what she reminds him of and things like that. It's very confronting. Mm. But this poor woman, Mary, is just this support for these two completely dysfunctional men. Mm. And it just hits a bit too close to home for me, basically. Mm. This idea that women can find themselves in a situation where they have to put up with this, incredibly egocentric.
But at the same time, he does have these moments where he's bearing her burden.
That's true.
Quite literally and manifestly.
Yeah.
I think, there is also in there, there's something about how that journey into oneself, the sort of self-reflexivity that takes place, can lead one into a state where they're consumed by an ideology or cause that is then taken over by an absence of hope and the consumption of despair, right? So you mentioned that the Michael's funeral in it is quite a beautiful scene.
Mm.
And it is, but in ways I found it just, I don't know if I can articulate this correctly, but in ways it just seemed very absurd.
Mm.
Like this reformed evangelical choir singing the Neil Young song where they say, who's going to stand up to corporate pollution and so on.
Yeah.
Right after, and he's chosen this as his song to be played after he's ended his own life and so on. Because of this despair in the context of him having a child and so on. And it just seems the whole thing is they're all standing there in this kind of absurdity that something has, not without reason, but that it's become this all-consuming power.
Yeah.
Which I find, is really interesting when he said, who would bring a little girl into this world.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said this to you before, but it reminded me of an Orthodox priest who in a post once said, would you bring a child into the world if you believe in the possibility of eternal damnation? Mm. He's asking as a parent, the risk of eternal damnation. What does that mean to actually bring a child into this state? But that's a fascinating construction because you think, I have a 2-year-old.
Yeah.
So what am I thinking? Well, I must be thinking that it can't simply be about despair.
Yeah. Yeah, it reminded me a lot of, especially the Marian imagery in the film reminded me a lot of one of Hannah Arendt's key concepts of natality. She has this, she thinks natality, meaning the fact that we are born, is the defining feature of the human condition. And this sets her against figures like Heidegger who see mortality, the fact that we're going to die, as the defining feature of human existence. The reason for Arendt that natality, the fact that we're born, is the defining feature is that with each new person who enters the world, an infinite set of possibilities opens up because human action is so unpredictable. And that is the hope for the world for Arendt, that the world replaces itself with a new generation, and this birth brings potential. And in the context of this film, we can see kind of this Marian figure carrying a child in her womb, and the men in her life, or at least Michael at least, can only see the child as a potential victim, whereas going with the Mary metaphor, the child could be actually reinterpreted as possible hope for the future.
Mm.
What type of child is this child going to be? Mm. Will this child be someone that will bring light to a darker and darker world? Mm. Walter Benjamin's terminology for this is weak messianic power, this idea that we all have a capacity to to break a chain of events, the flow of history as it's heading in a particular direction. All of a sudden, that chain of events can be ruptured by, and it's the Jewish concept of the messianic moment, the Messiah entering into history and rupturing things.
I think you could, I mean, you could complicate that and say that it's not that you're guaranteed that, you know, climate catastrophe will be avoided, but even in that context, the person, the newborn entering into the world changes things.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
Even into that, there is eruption of beauty amidst that despair, right? You know, it is going back to Tolkien's *U Catastrophe*. You know,
yeah, that's absolutely
it is
right.
The turn of events amidst the catastrophe.
Yeah, I just wanted to read a little. It's one of my favorite passages from *Arendt*. It's a very famous description of this idea of natality and the human capacity for action. And action for Arendt means political action, our capacity to bring a new series of events through acting in concert in the public sphere. And she says this, and it's one of the most beautiful depictions of Arendt's humanism. She says, "The miracle that saves the world, the realm of human affairs, from its normal natural ruin is ultimately the fact of natality, in which the faculty of action is ontologically rooted. It is, in other words, the birth of new men," by which she means people, "and the new beginning, the action they are capable of by virtue of being born. Only the full experience of this capacity can bestow upon human affairs faith and hope, those two essential characteristics of human existence which Greek antiquity ignored altogether, discounting the keeping of faith as a very uncommon and not too important in virtue, and counting hope among the evils of illusion in Pandora's box. It is this faith in and hope for the world that found perhaps its most glorious and most succinct expression in the few words with which the gospel announced their glad tidings. A child has been born unto us." I think that's just one of my favorite passages of political theory ever. But this idea that a new person is an almost infinite sets of new personalities. The world is irreversibly changed every time a new person comes into the world. Mm. And that doesn't mean the problems go away. Mm. It could be an incredibly horrendous world, but nonetheless, things are possible.
I think this is actually reflected in parenthood, as in this new person is bizarrely unique in their changing of the interrelationship between people, us to parents, to godparents and so on, and their development of themselves that is positioned in these relationships and thus changes the world around them. We're running out of time, but I really wanted us to just maybe take an extra moment to look at to raise one particular thing in this film as well. So this journey into his interiority, it sort of balances and it runs through the whole film, so he never loses it. Both, it is a journey and ascent into a sort of the spiritual depths of darkness in which he may also be communing with God, but also potentially slides into his own solipsistic or a kind of solipsistic despair in ways. But this also is precipitated by a deep sense of growing alienation. So Alyssa has this great, you mentioned her before, she's a film critic for Vox, and she has this great review on the piece, and she has this great line where she says, "The film understands in a rare and terrifying way the mental toll of feeling like either an exile or a dangerous apostate within one's faith community, alienated both from a caring God and from the platitudes that seem to satisfy others in the pew." And this is really dramatically displayed, for example, at the Abundant Life, the mega church with about 5,000 people, the evangelical church there, they have a cafeteria for the church itself. And on its wall, they have the passage from Book of Acts, "All the believers were one in heart and mind. No one claimed that any of their possessions was their own, but they shared everything." And it's fascinating because it's a sort of parody, because you have this communistic or communalistic understanding in the Book of Acts that's then turned into this corporatized manifestation of church that crowds out God and crowds out others and creates this sense of alienation that is manifest throughout the film entirely, in which this priest is, or this minister, is increasingly engaged with environmental creation and asks the question, will God forgive us? While those around him in the church seemingly go about doing what they see as the true business of the church, namely saving souls or whatever it is, right? And it's this feeling which you'd take it outside of that environmental care context, although that is incredibly palpable right there when you exist in a church that does not palpably care for God's creation, but just into a general feeling that sometimes you get the sense that it's not so much you're almost, it's not just that you're at a disjuncture with your church, but almost like you're sitting within a church that has become a parody.
Yeah. There's I think right at the beginning of the film, when he's approached for pastoral help, he basically refers them on to Abundant Life because they've got actual counselors on staff.
Right.
And Mary says to him, oh, Michael won't go there because it's more like a company than a church.
Yeah.
Which is a fascinating description.
Yeah.
Are we just about out of time? Well, go watch the film if you haven't already. And if you haven't and you listen to this, what are you doing, mate? it's fantastic stuff. Thank you so much for listening to us. Please like us. Please subscribe to us. Write us a review on whatever platform you listen to us to. Share us with your friends. Interact with us on social media. Thanks so much for the kind words and interactions that we've had so far. It's all very good. And we will follow us on Twitter at UCAT, that's EUCAT _ podcast on Twitter. And you can find us on Facebook as well. But thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week. Bye.